Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Hey, today we welcome a new co-host into the mix. Not only an expert in the field of biology, earth sciences, conservation and preservation, and fishing, but he's my dad. How about that? Today we welcome to the co-host seat my father, Byron Niederhelman. Welcome, Dad. How are you?
Thank you, Aaron. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, you have been a longtime listener of the show. I appreciate that. I think you may be forced to doing that. So thank you for taking the time. But now you get to see how the sausage is made.
Well, it's very interesting so far, and I look forward to the rest of the process.
Okay, well, very good. So I'm going to give a quick briefing, just like we do with other co-hosts, of your background and why this is applicable for today's conversation. So, well, with an undergrad in biology, a master's from nearby Northeastern University, you also taught biology and earth sciences for 19 years, and for 13 years, you were the principal of the high school that I attended. How about that?
Yes, that was a very unique experience, and I hope you survived it as well as I did.
Yeah, well, and actually, the way I wrote that, it makes it sound like I was at high school for 13 years. I was not there for 13 years. You were there for 13 years.
Correct.
Very good. And we never had that crossover aside from you being a teacher at that period of time.
That's right. Correct.
So, but, okay, so I should mention this also when you were principal. You took over as principal in your early 30s. And you knew that you had to look a little bit more senior, a little older. So you started the trend of the Niederhelman mustache. How about that?
Yes, and I see that it has continued to some extent.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it immediately adds 10 years, and it gives you all kinds of panache, right? You kind of walk through the room in a different way.
Well, that's what I assumed, and I hope it's true. At least I made it through the 13 years.
Very good. Byron Niederhelman is an avid sportsman, and for the last 25 years, he's been a busy traveler, traveling the globe in search of the best fishing spots throughout the world. So thanks again for joining. And I'm going to start by just saying that I remember as a kid where you tried to introduce me to fishing many times. And whether it was our local fly pond down in our hometown, or surf casting off the Cape, or on the Snake River, or up in the pristine waters of New Brunswick, you tried. And man, it just wasn't my thing. I get it. You know, you have to try different things. You have to tow different waters. But within 30 minutes, I would be distracted looking at other things happening in nature. But you've got the bug, as does my son, Luke, your grandson. But unfortunately, I never really connected with me in fishing. Funny enough, both times, you know, I actually tried to do this as well, personally, as I got older. And I bought a boat for fishing. I quickly realized that I was a gardener. Right. And so fishing just wasn't there. But as you get older, you realize what you like and where you find your calm. But fishing has always taken you to some special places in your life, and it's given you some incredible memories and experience. Could you share with our audience how fishing, especially fly fishing, has offered you a deep connection to the natural environment?
Yeah, I can, because it's very special to me. When I get out on a stream to do some fly fishing, it's a very pristine experience. There are generally not many other people around. I enjoy the environment. I enjoy the possibility of catching a fish. And it's just a very calming, happy experience.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of people find in it, right? In that connection, that feeling of calm. That's a good way to describe it. And I remember one place that you took me as a kid. It was near the Merrimack, the mouth of the Merrimack River, and it was for the annual Atlantic Salmon Run. In fact, about a year ago, you told me that the local Atlantic salmon was your favorite fish to catch and eat from throughout the world. Now, you fished and consumed salmon from Alaska, New Zealand, South America, and more, but your favorite comes from our waters. And as a New Englander focused on preserving the bounty of our waters, I think that's pretty cool. It's also a great transition in today's show. How about that? So for episode 92, we welcome Bill Taylor, who's the president and CEO of the world-renowned conservation organization, the Atlantic Salmon Federation. Bill, thanks for joining today's chat.
Hey, you're absolutely welcome, Aaron, and happy to be on the show with your dad, Byron, too. Byron, just from the few words you shared, it sounds like you and I have a lot in common.
Yes, we do, and I'm a little envious of the fishing experiences you had around the world, and at some point, I'd love to hear more about them.
Well, absolutely, and just to take, not to take us aside too much here, but just quickly, Aaron, I just came back late last night from a weekend of salmon fishing on the West River, Nova Scotia, which is an entirely public river, and just like your father, I mean, I love the connection to nature and wild Atlantic salmon, an amazing creature, and fly fishing takes me much closer to that whole experience and the great environments around that, but And I enjoy being on my own or just with a close friend or family member. But the public waters in Nova Scotia, it's a real social event. And I was sharing just a small stretch of river with a dozen people. We had a campfire going on the side of the river, you know, having cups of coffee because it's you're freezing cold and, you know, 40-degree water up to your chest. But I had my daughter with me, her boyfriend, my wife. There was probably a dozen of us, and we were lucky enough to catch 5 or 6 salmon to 12 pounds and release some great fights. You know, it was all spectacular, but it was a whole social element of it as well. And, you know, sitting on the side of the river, sharing stories and just having a good time. So it's all of that as well.
It is. It's a very communal and familial and great connection. I understand that. And it sounds like a great experience. In fact, I'm a sucker for the movie River Runs Through It. I loved it. I watched that, and I'm like, yes, I'm in. And then I just, you know, sometimes it just doesn't click. But I can appreciate it. We find that same kind of calm in so many things. So, Bill, a little bit about the Atlantic Salmon Federation. It's an international conservation organization established in 1948. The Federation is dedicated to the conservation, protection, and restoration of wild Atlantic salmon and the ecosystem on which the well-being and survival depend. So, Bill, could you tell us a little bit about your work?
So I'm the president and CEO of the Atlantic Salmon Federation, and you're correct. We're international. There's an Atlantic Salmon Federation Canada that was founded in 1948, an Atlantic Salmon Federation U.S., founded in 68. The two work together. Pool resources, there is one staff. We have an office in Brunswick, Maine, which runs our U.S. operations, focusing on, you know, trying to protect the last few remaining wild Atlantic salmon and just a handful of rivers in the state of Maine, the Penobscot and a half dozen of what's called the Down East Salmon Rivers, as well as the Kennebec. And then a lot of what we do is in Eastern Canada. So most of our work is North American-based. In Eastern Canada, the Atlantic provinces and Quebec, there's still relatively healthy wild Atlantic salmon runs throughout much of those areas, but there's all kinds of threats. And it's habitat loss, it's the threat of open net pen salmon farming, impacts from forestry and mining, agriculture on salmon habitat, unsustainable fisheries in some places. Wild Atlantic salmon aren't international fish themselves. They're anadromous, which means they spawn in fresh water. They spend anywhere from 4, 5, 6 years in the fresh water environment, and then they head out to sea, and many of them head to Greenland. So salmon from the Penobscot River in Maine or the Miramichi in New Brunswick or the Eagle River in Labrador, a lot of them will head to Greenland, and they'll spend 2 or 3 years feeding there before coming back to the same river where they were born to complete the life cycle. So taking care of Atlantic salmon, protecting, restoring them, conserving them means being good stewards of their freshwater environment, our rivers, but then also following them through international boundaries and across provincial state lines and at Greenland as well. So there's a lot to saving them. And, you know, I like to often, when we talk about wild Atlantic salmon, it's kind of like the canary in the coal mine when it comes to our freshwater and marine ecosystems. Wild Atlantic salmon need clean water to have clean water. water, healthy water. You have to have a healthy watershed, which means forestry and the riparian zones. And then there has to be a healthy marine environment as well. So when our salmon runs are in trouble, it should be a sign to us that you know, all is not well with our own world, kind of like the canary in the coal mine.
Interesting. Yeah, what a fascinating animal. As you said, the salmon runs put it in such a unique spot of the life cycle of this animal. Fascinating. And it, you had mentioned Greenland a few times in that intro. And I saw on your website that in 2018, you signed a landmark 12-year agreement with the Greenland fishermen to suspend the commercial harvest of salmon. And you limited it to subsistence quota. And that was a deal to save thousands of adult salmon annually. And I found that interesting, the fact, of course, investing in ecosystems and the animal themselves, but you're getting on the policy side of this as well, looking at it as a system solution. Can you tell us more about that landmark relationship?
Yes, absolutely, and happy to. And you know, again, whether we're talking about the Merrimack River or the Penobscot River or the Restigouche or, you know, some other river in Canada, we've got to take care of that freshwater environment. But the salmon, the large breeders in particular, the large spawners, the fish that spend two or more years at sea before coming back to spawn, which are our most valuable young fish producers, most of those fish go to Greenland. So the waters around southwest Greenland in particular are particularly rich in the salmon's preferred species like capelin and sand eels and shrimp and krill. So the Greenlanders have a stake in this as well, and the salmon are important to them. Even though they only have one or two salmon rivers, our salmon spend a good chunk, an important part of their life cycle, feeding on the forage fish at Greenland. So there has been a commercial fishery at Greenland since salmon were discovered feeding there back in the very early 1960s. And at the peak of the commercial fishery at Greenland, there was Russian fleets and Danes and Norwegians and Japanese, as well as the Greenlanders. And at the peak of the fishery in the 1970s, they were harvesting 2,000 metric tons of Atlantic salmon a year, which equates to almost a million fish. And our rivers, that's almost as many fish as all of our rivers in eastern North America produce. So in no time, the Greenland fishery was having a really severe impact on our wild Atlantic salmon runs here. There is a treaty for Atlantic salmon that is run through the North Atlantic Salmon Conservation Organization, an international treaty kind of like the United Nations for salmon, which regulates high seas fisheries, including the Greenland fishery, sets quotas, but it's all done on consensus basis, and just like the United Nations has a hard time getting out in front of an issue, is often playing catch-up. And even though the quotas at Greenland were reduced year after year after year, the abundance of salmon never, ever really rebounded and continued to spiral downwards. And now we have issues like climate change, which I can talk about later, impacting salmon as well. So the things we can control, like the number of fish that we kill, commercial fisheries, recreational fisheries, Greenland is a really important part of the equation. And the North Atlantic Salmon Conservation Organization did its best to control the fishery, but still it took a private effort led by the Atlantic Salmon Federation and our European partner, the North Atlantic Salmon Fund, reached an agreement with the fishermen themselves. So we recognize that salmon are an important part of the culture, heritage, diet of Greenlanders. There continues to be a subsistence level fishery at a very modest level, only 20 metric tons. And just in the last 2 years, our agreement has saved, as your intro mentioned, you know, thousands of Atlantic salmon. So you take that over the 12-year lifespan of this agreement, and it's going to be a huge, huge benefit to wild Atlantic salmon here in North America. And I think over the course of the agreement, you know, save tens and tens and tens of thousands of Atlantic salmon.
Bill, I noticed you made a reference to the canary in the coal mine. I assume that by that reference, you're referring to the fact that salmon are an early indicator of climate and environmental change. Is that true?
No, absolutely. And, you know, salmon are one of the first species in a river to show decline when the water quality is impacted. It's very sensitive to temperature and nutrient levels, chemical balance in a watershed. On that front, absolutely. I think the canary in the coal mine analogy fits. And then the same thing in the marine environment. So in order to have healthy Atlantic salmon runs, we need a healthy estuary, healthy marine or ocean environment, and healthy rivers as well. And when our salmon runs are in trouble, even when fisheries are greatly reduced or eliminated, if our salmon runs continue to decline, that's a sign that their environment, our environment, is not doing well either.
Now, what is the current salmon stock in the rivers that your association is monitoring in relation to past numbers?
If we look back, say, 50 years, if we go back to the late 60s, early 70s, there would have been an estimated 800,000 Atlantic salmon returning to North American rivers on an annual basis. Fluctuations, of course, like all things in nature, but just shy of a million adult salmon coming back to spawn. And that number has been reduced by half over the last 40 or 50 years. So certainly it's a serious concern. The declines are steepest in the southern range of the species, and that would make sense when you think of climate change and the fact that whether it's in Maine or the southern maritime provinces like New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, closer to urbanization, there's more industrial open net pen salmon farming, forestry is more intense, agriculture as well, mining, more urbanization, you're closer to people. The further north you go into the Gaspé of Quebec and Newfoundland, Labrador, the further you're away from civilization and the healthier our watersheds are, so the healthier the salmon populations are as well. But just coming back to climate change, we've seen a big change in our rivers and the marine environment just in the last decade. But if you look at the last, say, 20 or 30 years, it's quite scary. We're seeing temperatures in some of our fantastic Atlantic salmon rivers like the Miramichi. It used to be unusual to see the water temperature get above 72 or 4 degrees in the river for a day or two. And just last year, there was one tributary of the Miramichi that had 57 days where that was the case.
Well, that's a pretty dramatic change, and certainly a dramatic change in the number of salmon that you are supervising in that area. To what extent are the salmon fish farms having an effect on the wild population?
They're having a huge impact. I guess, looking at the glass is half full approach is, thankfully, open net pen salmon farms are only located in a handful of areas in North America. So there's a small number of fish farms in the state of Maine, quite a few more in the Bay of Fundy, the Maritime Provinces between New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and then again in southern Newfoundland. So that's a very modest percentage of wild Atlantic salmon habitat here in eastern North America. But in all of those areas, and those are the only areas, wherever industrial open net pen salmon farming exists in eastern North America, wild Atlantic salmon runs are either extinct or threatened with extinction. And you can even look across the Atlantic to Norway, to Scotland, and to Ireland, where industrial open net pen salmon farming exists, and it's the same thing there. To my knowledge, there is not an area in the North Atlantic where you have industrial open net pen salmon farming in anywhere close to healthy runs of wild Atlantic salmon. And then looking just at Newfoundland, which is a fairly large province in eastern Canada, out in the North Atlantic, very small population base, large mass, a couple of hundred great salmon rivers, very low level of agriculture or mining or forestry. I mean, there's some, but not like Ontario, Quebec. The only area where wild salmon are in trouble is on the southern coast And, you know, you got it right there is where the intensive industrial open-dip and salmon farming exists. And then just a month ago, there was an environmental catastrophe with open-dip and salmon farming there. Maui, MOWI, which is a huge Norwegian company, they had a 2.6, 2.8 million farm salmon die-off at a number of their locations, an absolute catastrophe with all these dead salmon rotting in their pens and waste washing up on beaches. So, you know, that's obviously a concern for wild salmon, but traditional commercial fishermen, you know, cod fishermen are upset, lobster fishermen are upset, tourism industry, just the people dealing with that. And in both cases, the industry, the company, and the province did their very best to cover it up, but the word has gotten out now. So, I mean, that's just one small example of the problems that plague this industry.
Hmm. Bill, I want to return back to these questions of wild salmon runs and farming, but I want to read a bit more of your bio here. So Bill Taylor joined the staff of the Atlantic Salmon Federation in 1988, and 7 years later, he was appointed president and CEO. He serves on several regional, national, and international conservation boards and committees, and he has received several awards in recognition of his work in the Atlantic salmon conservation area, including the Ted Williams Award in recognition of journalistic excellence in support of salmon conservation. It's always good to get a Ted Williams Award. That's good stuff.
It sure is.
That's right. So, you know, coming back, actually, you had mentioned, we talked about that half of the wild run salmon stock was lost in the last few years. Initiatives like the Greenland Agreement helping to try to replenish that stock. But also in 2011, I saw that you calculated the economic impact of Atlantic salmon for Canada was $255 million annually and supported over 4,000 jobs. One article I read about that stated that in the political climate that we're in, money talks and government tends to invest in industries that provide economic benefits and jobs in communities or to communities. So how did this approach of calculating the bottom line of conservation, how was it received by the different stakeholders?
It was received well in that study. So we commissioned Gardner Pinfoll Consulting, which is a very reputable Canadian company. We wanted this done, you know, by an unbiased third party, reputable third party. And that study continues to be used by the Government of Canada and some of the provinces. And actually, Aaron, going back to one of the main reasons the Atlantic Salmon Federation commissioned that study was that we often heard from the open net pen salmon farming lobby that salmon farming is worth $200 million to the maritime economy and supports a couple of thousand jobs and so on. And, you know, we took a step back and said, well, you know what? Wild Atlantic salmon have to be worth at least that much. And when you think about the areas where our wild salmon rivers are, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Northern Quebec, Labrador, those are areas where there's not a lot of other opportunity for good employment. And along those rivers, salmon angling is what drives a lot of those local economies. And it's not just fishermen fishing out of lodges and paying for guides, but at the lodges and the camps, you've got kitchen staff employed, and you have camps being built, and you have canoes being built, and you have motors that go with it, and all the camps have to buy their groceries somewhere, and people traveling up from Boston, New York, and airfares, and so on. So the spinoffs are huge, and the job calculations as well. Those 4,000 jobs are based on an annual basis, and salmon angling is not an annual operation. You know, the season throughout most of eastern Canada, salmon angling starts on June 1st and ends either on September 30th or October 15th or October 30th, depending where you're fishing. So you're talking about 4 or 5 months. So those 4,000 jobs, you probably multiply those by 2 or 3 times to get the true employment value. So like I say, I mean, our governments continue to use that study. It is entirely relevant. It's green industry. All of the salmon fisheries in eastern Canada now, just about all of them, are totally catch and release. So, you know, people are, yes, they're angling, and yes, they're, you know, catching lots of salmon. But in most cases, those fish are being released back so they can actually spawn and contribute to the future health of the run. So it's green industry, and it's really important to a lot of areas here in eastern Canada.
Yeah, my experience as a fisherman in New Hampshire for wild salmon has been frustrating, to say the least. As a salmon fisherman, I'm sure you've heard the expression, it takes 1,000 casts to catch a salmon. Well, in New Hampshire, it's been more than 1,000, and my arm condition has occasionally demonstrated that. Back in 1993, the Merrimack River Atlantic Salmon Restoration Project developed a salmon broodstock fishery, which lasted until 2013. It ended, as I understand it, because of poor survival rate, which we've been talking about, and shifting priorities within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As a fisherman, that's kind of frustrating. And I know that we're quite a bit further south than you're working in your association. But what is your perception of what's happening south of Newfoundland and Greenland?
Well, I certainly understand your frustration, Byron. In the Merrimack part of the Connecticut River watershed, a lot of dams. I mean, right off the top of my head, I know it's multiple dams, and I'm not sure the exact number. But the further south we go in salmon country, and historically salmon, Atlantic salmon range from the Hudson to the very tip of Ungava in North America, and they still use Greenland as their feeding areas, but you know, there were salmon in the Hudson everywhere north. When I started with the Atlantic Salmon Federation in 1988, I used to travel from St. Andrews, New Brunswick, southern tip of New Brunswick, down to the Penobscot River in Maine, just a two-hour drive, and caught salmon in the Penobscot River. In fact, my wife caught her first salmon in the Penobscot River. And also the down east rivers, the Pleasant, Machias, East Machias, Denny's, Sheepscot, a bunch of wonderful little rivers along the Maine coast. And there was a reasonably successful Connecticut River, Merrimack River restoration program going on during that time, mid-late 80s through the 90s up until around 2000. And it showed promise. I can't remember the exact year, but mid-90s, late 90s on the Connecticut, there was a couple of years with over 500 fish coming back, and then returns began to drop off, and then quite precipitously as well, and with no known or at least seen variables, people wondering why, because the program had pretty much stayed the same, but return rates were very, very low. In the mid-late 1990s, there was a dramatic change in the North Atlantic ecosystem, and a lot of prey species, for some reason, phytoplankton, and then everything up the food web, capelin, sand eels, krill, shrimp, and so on, also took a nosedive, and that's when the cod crash in the North Atlantic and other species as well. And there was a big spike in predator populations like seals. So ocean survival for Atlantic salmon dropped significantly. I'm not exactly sure what the survival rate was in the Merrimack. I know it would be quite small, but on rivers that we do have a long-term data set, like the Miramichi River in New Brunswick, the Restigouche River in New Brunswick, even the Penobscot River in Maine, survival from outgoing smolt, that's the juvenile salmon that spent maybe 3, 4, 5 years in the river as a young salmon, and then getting to smolt stage, going out into the marine environment, that's when it leaves the river out to the ocean. Survival from outgoing smolt to returning adult to spawn was ranging from 5 to even 10% on some rivers. Today, on those very same rivers, Miramichi, Restigouche, it's at 1-2%, and on the Penobscot River, it's even less than 1%. So you're not even replacing the outgoing smolt with returning adult ratios. So it's something has changed out there. It's climate driven. There's climate change. There's changes in forage fish populations, the abundance of forage fish declining, the increase in predator populations like seals. And then when you're looking at rivers like the Merrimack and even Penobscot, it gets really complicated and really difficult because you have warming rivers inland. You're dealing with multiple dams so that successful restoration is extremely difficult. I know that's a long-winded answer, but sounded like you deserved it.
Well, I appreciate your insight into my experience. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
He's nursing his arm over here, Bill. You should say he's got a cast on him.
Well, I wish. Byron did mention the salmon, and they, 20, 30 years ago, they were called the fish of 1,000 casts. I think today it's more like the fish of 10,000 casts.
Mm. Yes.
Bill, I wanted to come back to the discussion around fish farming, and we got and taking this a little higher level here, we got half the world's population, or 40% of the world's population, are relying on fish for their major caloric intake, and it's estimated that 50% of fish are now farm raised. But as we've all known, and you even mentioned some of the detrimental practices, environmental impact of Maui and other fish farmers, but many of the farm-raised fish has received a bad rap for shortcuts like overuse of antibiotics, cheap engineered feedstuff, inbreeding amongst stock, and feedlot environments, really like CAFOs, for three-dimensional CAFOs for fish. But are there positive practices out there for raising fish, and are we seeing change that would be more biomimetic?
Absolutely. And we do. I mean, people do need their fish. They do need their omega-3s and so on. And people love salmon. I mean, in all honesty, maybe salmon shouldn't be farmed. It's a carnivorous fish, so you have to take protein out of the ocean to produce salmon protein. But that's what the consumer wants. And there are much more sustainable farming practices for salmon, and we're seeing them today, much more sustainable than the open net pen, industrial open net pen model. And that is raising salmon in closed containment, and in many cases, it's closed containment on land, so that it's a recirculating system. One, the farmer controls the environment, which is huge, so that the fish, if there ever was a disease, it can be contained into one site and not spread to wild fish or further down the farm line. But the farmer is able to capture all the uneaten food and waste, so there's a lot less pollution. There's absolutely no chance of escapes. With the open net pen model, farm salmon escape by the tens of thousands all the time, and those farm salmon run up rivers and breed with wild fish, and that weakens the wild gene pool. And then over just a few generations, the wild salmon are completely wiped out. There's all kinds of disease in open net pen farms, infectious salmon anemia, bacterial kidney disease, that spreads to wild salmon as well. Sea lice is another big problem in the open net pen model. The farmer can treat his farm salmon for sea lice with pesticides, which isn't good, but that's what they do. But the sea lice then can spread to wild salmon. And then there's no use, there's antibiotics that the open net pen farmer has to use as well. In the controlled land-based closed containment model, almost all of those problems are not just reduced, but eliminated. I mean, there's no chance of disease spreading to wild fish, no chance of sea lice. All the uneaten food and waste are captured, in some cases used as and sold as fertilizer. It's a wild salmon-friendly, wild fish-friendly, environmentally friendly way to raise fish, and not just salmon. There are other species as well, tilapia, of course. And with Atlantic salmon, we're seeing companies like Atlantic Sapphire, Sustainable Blue, Captor, Keturah, Whole Oceans. There's big land-based closed containment fish farms already built, a couple in Nova Scotia, Atlantic Sapphire in Denmark, Keturah in British Columbia. There's some big farms under development and under construction. Atlantic Sapphire has a huge facility under construction in Florida. Whole Oceans looking at one in Maine and Connecticut. These farms, you can locate them close to the markets, so you actually reduce the carbon footprint as well. With the open net pen model, you're talking about raising salmon in waters where they're conducive to raising salmon in the ocean, so you're looking at the Bay of Fundy or Newfoundland, and you still have to transport those fish to Montreal or Toronto or Boston or New York. And with the land-based closed containment model, you can put the farms anywhere, put them close to the market.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a great deal of sense. And in these RAS systems, Bill, so you, the Atlantic Salmon Federation has always been an ecosystem investment looking at the natural-run salmon, but as a consumer, I'm going to ask this and say, look, the misnomer out there is always going to buy the fresh caught, open caught salmon. And it does sound like there are systems out there that do it better than others. Is this something that the Atlantic Salmon Federation would get involved in helping us understand and appreciate what are good RAS systems compared to others?
Absolutely. And we've done, it's probably been 7 or 8 years, we've had a close relationship over that period with the Conservation Fund Freshwater Institute, the Conservation Fund in West Virginia, world-leading conservation organization doing a lot of business models, not just looking at fish farming, but lots of ways of doing business more sustainably. And they have really been the leader when it comes to land-based closed containment or these RAS, recirculated aquaculture system models. And I think a lot of the various companies have tweaked their systems just a little bit, but essentially they're all pretty much aligned and using very similar technologies. We're right on the front edge of this technology and seeing these farms and then the products they're producing hitting the markets. And we get the sense that the consumers are really going to gravitate to this. These land-based systems produce an excellent product. A lot of people say much better tasting product than open net pen models. The fact that you don't have to use pesticides or antibiotics, that it's environmentally friendly, wild salmon friendly. I think that there could be a real marketing edge for these land-based closed containment systems. And with what we see on the horizon here, companies like Atlantic Sapphire, Sustainable Blue are going to be producing a lot of fish and actually competing with the open net pen model for the consumer's dollar.
Sounds like a very positive evolution. So, Dad, as the co-host, I will say, do you have a final question or final thought that you have for Bill?
Yes, I would. Thanks, Aaron. Excuse me. Bill, as a high school biology teacher, I've been involved in several student projects, which I think are related to your association objectives. My biology classes, for example, were involved in a water quality testing project in a local river. After I retired, I was involved in an elementary school project in which the students observed salmon eggs hatch in an aquarium, and then at an appropriate stage of development, the salmon were placed in a local river. Both of these projects have a great potential for educating future generations of adults about the human impact on our environment. Has the ASF developed any type of plan of action for educating the public about our individual and collective responsibility to protect our environment?
We sure have, Byron. And actually, the program that you were alluding to, we did have a hand in developing that curriculum. In Eastern Canada, it was called Fish Friends, where classrooms grades 4, 5, and 6 had a 20 or 30 gallon aquarium in the classroom and raised salmon eggs and learned all about the biology and life cycle of Atlantic salmon and river restoration and so on. And at its peak, I think there were 600 schools that were involved. It had it wasn't called Fish Friends in the U.S., but in the state of Connecticut and in the state of Maine, there were several dozen, if not over 100 schools that ran their, called it Salmon in the Schools program. Again, I think grade 4, 5, 6 with a very similar curriculum. So, you know, educating, heightening public awareness, our youth, absolutely, because they are, you know, they're going to take over when we're no longer fighting the good fight, and hopefully do an even better job than we have. But educating that next generation, making them aware of the importance of a healthy environment, the role that, that salmon, wild salmon, play in that environment, the connection to nature and a healthy watershed, what drives it, healthy forest, river corridor, riparian zone, healthy ocean, all of those things, the interplay between prey and predators, and then just the general public at large. I mean, you and I are anglers, salmon anglers, fly fishermen, so we get it. But it's also kind of a self-interest for us, so we should get it. But what about the, you know, the greater public, which really is going to have the influence on government policy, and at the end of the day, it's policies and laws that will save our planet, and that is just bringing attention throughout eastern North America that wild Atlantic salmon are that canary in the coal mine. They're just as important, just as valuable as eagles or, you know, bison or panda bears or blue whales that, that the public gravitates to when it comes to conservation and environmentalism. When I think of eastern Canada and New England, at least for me, you know, very few, if any, species resonate or could resonate with the public like Atlantic salmon. When, you know, when you think of an Atlantic salmon going from Greenland all the way back to the Merrimack River before the dams were there, and leaping waterfalls and dealing with sharks and seals at sea, and dealing with the predators they have to deal with in the rivers, it's a pretty pretty amazing story. So education, heightened public awareness, both youth but just generally is I think extremely important and part of the answer.
Well, it sounds as though our project probably was developed by your association, and based on that fact, I feel like we've closed a circle today. I appreciate your information, and I think salmon are a great way to further educate the public about our responsibility to the environment. So thank you very much.
Yeah, Bill, thank you so much for your work, for taking the time. It sounds like some of the information that you've worked on, whether it's the Greenland agreement or the economic impact report from 2011, or even some of this new initiatives in looking at the future of farming fish, would be available on your website. And I can include a link in the write-up for this. Is that the best place for our listeners to read more?
Yes, absolutely, Aaron, and thank you.
You're welcome, of course. And well, thank you so much for taking the time to share this type of wisdom with our listening audience. Dad, thank you for co-hosting. Good stuff.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Hey, thank you. Thank you both very much.
Take care.